ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Victorian police urge the man accused of killing two of their colleagues to surrender. Also, Federal MP Bob Katter in the news again after warning a journalist he might get punched. And an ancient jawbone gives us clues about early human life.
When you find something, it's absolutely amazing. Anything, you know, even just a small bit of bone or a small piece of a broken pot, it's amazing to find things that people in the past had been handling.
First this evening, call us and arrange to surrender. That's the message Victorian police have today sent to the man accused of shooting dead two of their colleagues and wounding another on Tuesday. Desi Freeman fled into dense bushland near the town of Porepunkah in Victoria's northeast after the alleged ambush and hasn't been seen since. Police believe he is most likely still in the area and are urging people to stay well clear if they spot the heavily armed fugitive. Kimberly Price filed this report from Porepunkah.
In Victoria's high country, the search continues for 56-year-old Desi Freeman, the man who allegedly shot and killed two police officers and wounded another on Tuesday morning. He was last seen by police, heavily armed and fleeing into bush from the property where the confrontation happened. Russell Barrett is Victoria Police's Acting Deputy Commissioner for Regional Operations.
We have a major police operation going on here at the moment. We have every available asset, every capability the Victoria Police has. We have assistance from other policing organisations here on the ground in an effort to quickly apprehend the offender.
Police aren't only searching the mountainous bushland, they're also knocking on doors.
We've got a number of properties that we're searching, and there's a number of inquiries open to us, and we were working through them systematically.
Superintendent Brett Kahn says the search area is extremely challenging.
It's really difficult terrain. It's complex terrain, and it's not something that we, even with our specialist resources, can move through quickly because it is dangerous terrain as well. I think the other thing that we haven't said, if Desi Freeman's watching this, ring 000 and we will support a surrender plan. That option's open to him, absolutely.
And he also warned members of the public not to approach Desi Freeman if they see him. The shooting occurred when 10 police officers visited a rural property outside of Porepunkah, about 300 kilometres northeast of Melbourne. They were there to execute a search warrant relating to historical sex offences. The two officers killed were Detective Leading Senior Constable Neil Thompson and Senior Constable Vadim Devart. Today in Federal Parliament, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese paid his respects to the two men.
As a parliament, as a country, we offer our deepest condolence to all whose worlds have been shattered by this horrific shooting. Our hearts go out to everyone whose heart is breaking.
Opposition leader Susan Lee also paid tribute.
The loss of Neil and Vadim serves as a stark reminder not only of the danger that police officers face each day, but of the bravery and courage it takes to serve. Every police officer who puts on that uniform to go to work has our respect and gratitude. All Australians stand shoulder to shoulder with Victoria Police at this moment of profound sadness.
As grey skies loom over Porepunkah with cold, wet weather, a small piece of normalcy has returned, with the town's primary school reopening today. The school's principal is Jill Gillies.
It's about coming together, reconnecting and, having a fun day, taking the kids' minds off the things that may have happened in our beautiful community.
Jean-Francois Rupp was happy to drop his son off for school this morning.
My wife's a school teacher, so it makes things a little bit easier. But yeah, I don't think many parents would take the kids to school, and I can't blame them for that.
Desi Freeman is a self-described sovereign citizen, which is a movement that does not believe in the legitimacy of government, courts and police. As for how difficult it will be to find Freeman, who's described as a skilled bushman, experts say there are several factors at play. Gordon Dedman is a survival instructor with the Australian Army and Bushcraft Survival Australia, which runs adventure courses in northeast Victoria.
He would have bush skills. The country, it's very thick, really, really thick. As a hunter, he'd be probably out there, but of course, in survival being the cold, it's just all comes down to your, once again, your priorities as far as being dressed, like in the protection elements, first aid clothing, shelter fire.
Victoria Police say Desi Freeman was wearing dark green khaki tracksuit pants and a dark green rain jacket.
Your first line of defence against environmental factors is your clothing. So what he went in there with, him, whether he has a stash of clothing somewhere, and if it's a prepper, he could well have that.
Gordon Dedman says shelter would also be a key to survival in the alpine terrain. But in a valley with plenty of streams and rivers, water and food are of less concern.
10 days without food is not a long time in the survival realm.
He says the steep mountains will also be a challenge for police's search efforts.
The police have obviously numbers, and the fact that they can be resupplied and they can be refreshed, where he won't have that, he'll be continuing on the run, and so that he's going to be worn down by it, get tired after a while. But his advantage is he knows the area.
Police repeated today that they do not believe Desi Freeman has left the Porepunkah area.
Kimberly Price reporting there from Porepunkah in northeastern Victoria. After a long-running legal saga, a former tax office employee has today avoided a criminal conviction and jail time after blowing the whistle on what he believed were aggressive debt collection practices by the Australian Tax Office. Richard Boyle initially raised his concerns with his employer, but after they were dismissed by the ATO, he went public, speaking to the ABC's Four Corners program in 2018. Advocates for greater protections for Australian whistleblowers argue he should never have been prosecuted. Luke Radford reports.
Arm in arm with his wife, Richard Boyle walks out of the Adelaide District Court relieved. And after nearly 7 years of scrutiny, he only had one thing to say.
I just want to say thank you to all the supporters. That's all for today. Thank you very much. Really appreciate everyone over the last 6 or 7 years supporting me and Louise. Thank you very much.
Having pleaded guilty to 4 charges earlier this year, today Richard Boyle was spared a conviction. While the case is over, the Commonwealth prosecutor still has a right to appeal. Supporters of Boyle, like former Senator Rex Patrick, hope that isn't the case.
I hope the Commonwealth does not appeal this. I think that would just be an incredible political move if they did. Richard has suffered for 8 years. He's still suffering. This has to end. I think justice has been, in a very small way, served today with the no convictions.
Richard Boyle's battle with the tax office began back in 2017. As a debt collection officer with the agency, he blew the whistle internally over debt collection practices he believed were unethical. When he felt his complaints were ignored, he went public with the allegations on the ABC's Four Corners program in 2018. The revelations led to multiple inquiries and changes within the tax office. But Mr. Boyle was subsequently accused of disclosing protected information, making a record of protected information, using a listening device to record a private conversation, and recording another person's tax file number. All in all, he faced 66 charges and up to 161 years in prison, although over time, many charges were withdrawn. Mr. Boyle's wife, Louise, revealed the personal toll when speaking to the ABC's 7:30 program 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's the kind of toll it's taken on me personally. It's just like, is my husband still alive? Is he going to be dead when I arrive home because of the stress that we've both been put through for years and years?
While Richard Boyle has now escaped with no conviction and just a 12-month good behaviour bond, advocates say the case has had a chilling effect on whistleblowers. Kieran Pender is the Associate Legal Director at the Human Rights Law Centre.
I hear from whistleblowers every week. They say that they are scared to speak up because of cases like this. The prosecution of whistleblowers in recent years in Australia has had a really chilling effect on Australian democracy, on truth-telling, on transparency. If people like Richard don't speak up about wrongdoing, we don't have accountability, we don't have justice.
He says this case proves the current rules are broken.
Point is, the law needs to strike the balance here. The effect of this appeal is that whistleblowers are only protected for the actual act of disclosure. There has to be a line drawn somewhere, and we know that if whistleblowers don't have some protection, the laws won't work effectively.
So what can actually change? AJ Brown is a professor of public policy and law at Griffith University.
One is that the law needs to be reformed to make it clearer that the protections do apply to acts that are associated with whistleblowing, like reasonable acts to collect evidence or record evidence that is actually needed to demonstrate that a person has a complaint or a disclosure that they're trying to make. That was the loophole that let this prosecution be brought in the first place.
Professor Brown says an agency should be established dedicated to issues relating to whistleblowers.
This really clearly demonstrates is the need for a whistleblower protection authority or agency whose approval or support is needed before a prosecution or charges like this could be brought, simply to stop an agency, in this case the tax office, and to actually to stop the DPP from going down the wrong road of pursuing a massive and costly and wasteful and pointless prosecution exercise like this one.
In a statement, the Attorney General's office says the government is committed to delivering strong, effective and accessible protections for public sector whistleblowers through staged reform of the Public Interest Disclosure Act.
Luke Radford reporting from Adelaide. The flamboyant Queensland MP Bob Katter is in the news again today, this time for threatening a journalist with physical violence. The Channel 9 reporter had asked the veteran Polly a question about his Lebanese heritage at a press conference. Mr Katter was there to speak in support of the so-called March for Australia, an anti-immigration rally being held this weekend. Elizabeth Cramsey prepared this report.
In front of Queensland's Parliament House, Bob Katter talked of his plans to attend an anti-immigration rally on Sunday.
Anyone that treats our flag badly, we're taking their names down. You know, the gloves are coming right off now.
But the gloves came off a bit earlier than expected when Nine News reporter Josh Bavis asked the veteran MP about his own family's heritage.
You've got Lebanese heritage yourself?
Oh, mate, don't say that, because that irritates me and I punch blokes in the mouth for saying that. Don't you dare say that. My family have been in this country for 140 years, right? So you, and if you say anything like that, I have on many occasions punched blokes in the mouth, right? So I'm restraining myself today. Don't say it. I'm not listening to you. You're out.
But that wasn't the end of it. When a second journalist attempted to clarify, Bob Katter continued his tirade. And when Josh Bavis tried to explain himself...
I'm sure that don't you said say that, because you're a racist. You're a racist.
And the confusion is understandable, given what Mr Katter's sister Geraldine O'Brien said of their grandfather in a recent episode of Australian Story.
The family story is that my grandfather, Jiddi we called him, came from Lebanon when he was in his early teens.
A number of Bob Katter's fellow politicians have expressed shock at the outburst. Queensland's opposition leader, Stephen Miles, joined the chorus.
Oh, look, there's just no place for physical threats and attempts at intimidation in any workplace. Journalists play a really important role, asking us questions each and every day. That's their job, and he shouldn't have threatened him in that way.
Peter Grester is a professor of journalism at Macquarie University and the executive director of the Alliance for Journalists' Freedom.
Anybody that puts themselves into politics has got to expect some fairly robust questioning from journalists. Now, I heard the question from the journalist and that there was nothing that I could see that was explicitly or implicitly racist. What they were doing was simply interrogating the apparent contradiction in what Bob was talking about, that is stopping migrants from countries that weren't democracies, that weren't predominantly Christian, that had records of human rights abuses and so on, and pointing out the obvious contradiction that he himself was from immigrant stock that came from a country that was exactly those things that he was just describing.
Amy Nethery is an associate professor of policy and politics at Deakin University.
I think what we saw from Bob Katter today, even though he is a colourful character, as he's often described, and he really pushes the boundaries often of, or goes up against the boundaries of acceptable behaviour from a politician, I think what we saw this morning was really overstepping the mark for what we deem acceptable by our elected representatives.
She says politicians need to exhibit appropriate workplace behaviour regardless of where they're working.
They need to abide by really good professional workplace behaviour in the office, in Parliament, But also because they are public figures, when they step outside the door of Parliament, when they're in their electorate, and especially when they're speaking to the media.
Qatar Australia Party leader Robbie Katter, who was standing by his father's side during the press conference, isn't backing down either.
If you're saying, am I going to condemn this situation? No, far from it. You know, we did our best to try and to assist and guide the questioning and you provoke a response.
The Parliamentary Code of Behaviour says bullying and harassment are behaviours that could lead to sanctioning. Any complaint against Mr Katter would have to be investigated by the Independent Parliamentary Standards Commission.
Elizabeth Cramsey with that report. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The massive Australian conglomerate Wesfarmers has today announced a profit of $2.9 billion. That's up 14% from last year. Wesfarmers has an unusual business model in that it not only owns retailers like Target, Kmart, Officeworks and Bunnings, but also lithium mines and chemical companies. The hardware giant Bunnings has been under particular scrutiny this year after an ABC Four Corners program aired allegations that the chain uses its market power to block competitors operating near it and to pressure suppliers, including plant growers, to deliver products at prices that threaten the viability of those small businesses. The ABC's chief business correspondent Ian Verinder spoke to Wesfarmers Managing Director Rob Scott after today's profit result was announced and asked him if he's seeing signs of improvement in the economy now that the Reserve Bank has cut interest rates.
Pleasingly, we have seen a bit of an improvement in consumer sentiment and consumer spending. We mentioned today that we had seen a bit of a tick up in consumer spending in Bunnings. We've also seen customers in our Kmart business start to spend a bit more on higher priced products. So that is encouraging, and it shows that the interest rate cuts and moderating inflation is starting to help a bit. But on the flip side, business customers are still doing it tough. It doesn't matter if you're a small, medium or large business, there's still a fair bit of cost pressure that businesses are trying to navigate. We have over 1.5 million business customers across our businesses, and their demand is still pretty soft.
The economic roundtable that everybody was focused on, the spotlight was on productivity growth. Now, everyone talks about what the government should do. What role do you think business should play?
Well, I think business has an enormous role to play in productivity because at the end of the day, it's business that creates the vast majority of jobs and prosperity. So big role for business. If I think about what we're doing in Wesfarmers, we invest an enormous amount on trying to improve our efficiency. We invest a lot in new businesses, opportunities such as our health division or our new lithium processing plant. So it's investment in both doing things smarter and creating new opportunities for growth. And also, I should note, investing in sustainability. So through investments we've made, we were able to reduce our emissions by 9.3% at a time when we were growing our business. And often what it takes in business to drive productivity is reducing the clutter, reducing a lot of duplication, empowering people to work in smarter ways, not harder. It's not about working harder, it's about working smarter. And, you know, in our business, that's really helped.
Yeah, despite, you know, years of weak business investment, our big corporations are continuing to send cash back to shareholders, though, rather than pump it back into the business. Do you think that might change?
Well, look, I think you can do both, Ian. I think a couple of things. We've invested billions and billions of dollars. I think we've invested over $5 billion in growth CapEx in the last few years. We've invested $2.5 billion in technology. We've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in lower prices. And at the same time, we have distributed the profits that we've generated back to shareholders in fully franked dividends. There are over 13 million Australians that benefit from Wesfarmers dividends through their super funds or a direct holding. And dividend imputation, so for your listeners that understand the benefit of franked dividends, the very high levels of company tax that we pay, our shareholders get the benefit of the franking credits associated with that. So it's really important that we do pay those distributions. And we think that companies can do both. They can do what's right for shareholders with dividends, but they can also invest in the future.
Bunnings has been under fire recently. Suppliers and competitors have complained that it's misused its dominant market position. How have you responded to that? What have you done to try and alleviate those concerns?
Well, I know that Bunnings take those concerns very seriously. Clearly, competitors don't like it when Bunnings comes to town because it makes their life a bit tougher. But putting that aside, when we hear complaints of suppliers that felt that they weren't being treated well, that is very much a minority of cases, and the data has shown that. But if Bunnings have done something wrong, they want to fix it up immediately. So we have put in some stronger processes with groups like Greenlife Australia. So these are some of our nursery suppliers. I think through the recent government inquiries, there were 4 complaints that were made, 2 of which date back about 8 to 10 years. But notwithstanding that, the Bunnings team are very keen to address those issues through better processes, better ability for our suppliers to raise issues and for them to be dealt with on a fair basis.
Rob Scott is the Managing Director of Wesfarmers. He was speaking to the ABC's Chief Business Correspondent, Ian Verinder. A team of archaeologists has discovered a human jawbone that's nearly 2 million years old in Georgia, a country that's often described as being at the crossroads of Europe and Asia. They believe the jaw is the oldest human relic ever excavated outside Africa, and they're hoping it'll give us more clues about prehistoric human settlements in Eurasia. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
In so small place, we find human rest, human bones. Big information about humankind.
Stone Age archaeologist Professor Georgi Bidzinashvili has been digging on a small, dusty plot of land alongside a team of fellow archaeologists from around the world. That site, around 100 kilometres from the Georgian capital and no bigger than 2 car parking spaces, is called Orozmani. It's here that the group has just uncovered a human jawbone, estimated to be 1.8 million years old. That makes it the oldest human remains ever found outside of Africa.
The site gives us opportunity for wider understanding of human evolution and early dispersal out of Africa, because Orozmani is the oldest site with human presence dated back 1.8 million years old.
It's not the first time archaeologists have made significant discoveries in this part of Georgia about prehistoric human settlements. They've previously dug up teeth and human skulls. University of Helsinki's Associate Professor Mika Talavara, who was also on site, says these remains offer clues to the way early hunter-gatherer species lived and migrated around 2 million years ago.
And if you want to study like how adaptable these early humans were, in which kind of environments they were able to live, these are key locations.
The team also found a cache of stone tools and animal fossils on site which give clues about what these early humans ate. It comes as archaeologists around the world are slowly chipping away at dig sites to uncover more about where we came from. University of Sydney archaeology lecturer Dr. Melissa Kennedy says depending on what you're trying to find, this process can take years.
When you're going out on a dig, it's very long days. You're generally starting at sort of 5-6 in the morning and working through till sort of 8 or 9 at night, probably about 6 days a week. Everyone thinks that it should move really fast, that it's just moving dirt, but it's not. Every bucket of dirt has to get sieved. You're collecting bags of soil for the archaeobotanist to look for ancient seeds. The bones get collected. They get brushed and analysed by the person who does the zoology. So, you know, there's so many different people going on an excavation that it takes just such a long period of time.
And while archaeological teams always set out with a plan to find something, Dr. Kennedy says digs are typically full of surprises and thrilling discoveries.
When you find something, it's absolutely amazing. Anything, you know, even just a small bit of bone or a small piece of a broken pot, you know, that's something that someone had, you know, 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, even, you know, 200 years ago. So I work in sort of the prehistoric period, so the time before written records. And so we don't have you know, wall reliefs or writings that people can tell us about the past. So it's really the only way we can learn how people actually lived and what they did.
Dr. Melissa Kennedy is an archaeology lecturer at the University of Sydney. That report from Julia Bergen. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The police officers had gone to execute a search warrant on a normal Wednesday morning in a sleepy Alpine village. But the day turned to tragedy, with so-called sovereign citizen Desi Freeman allegedly killing two of the officers and wounding another. Today, Four Corners reporter Mahmoud Fazal, who recently spent time with sovereign citizens, on what's unfolded. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.